Item 1212, please, Carla.
Accept the citywide tree policy review and regulatory improvement project report.
Commissioner Fritz.
Thank you, Mayor. It is my particular pleasure to introduce the budget and staffing implementation report for the citywide tree project for multiple reasons. One, I am now in charge of both parks and the Bureau of Development Services, and so I'm the lead for the council on this project. But second of all, because I helped get it going as a community activist back in 2005 when Southwest Neighborhoods joined with first East Portland and then with many neighborhoods citywide to ask the city to do this project. So that citizen-led effort, which we will hear about in just a moment, resulted in adoption of the citywide tree policy review and regulatory improvement project, quite the mouthful, in City Council in April of 2011. The project was accepted for funding by council in February in 2007-08 in response to the community concerns about how the city regulates its trees, primarily the lack of regulatory consistency and predictability, and poor customer service. In May of this year, council voted to extend the effective implementation date from July of 2013 to January of 2015 due to the budget constraints. Council, led by Commissioners Fish and Saltzman, then directed staff from Development Services, Parks, and Environmental Services to return to Council in December of 2013 with a budget and staffing implementation plan for the tree project. So here we are today. In response, the staff from the three bureaus have been working diligently over the last 6 months to ready the city for successful implementation of this new multi-bureau program. The presentation you're about to hear lays out the budget and staffing needs, which is the focus of today's discussion. We begin with opening remarks from the directors of Parks, Development Services, and Environmental Services. So if you could please come forward, worthy directors. After that, we'll have a short technical presentation, and then two panels of invited testimony, and then open citizen testimony. So thank you, everybody, for being here. We appreciate those of you who have been able to stay due to the delay. Director Abate.
Thank you, Commissioner Fritz. Mike Abate, Portland Parks and Recreation. And as you know, Portland Parks and Recreation is responsible for managing the city's urban forest. The new tree code, unlike the current code, is responsive to public demand for really three things. First, improve customer service infrastructure, sort of one-stop shopping, by adding expert staff with knowledge of both trees and of the code. Number two, to make sure that tree preservation and increased enforcement capabilities are in place for the city. And thirdly, that there is more understandable and consistent regulations. And these new regulations will ensure that Portland's urban canopy will be protected and continue to grow over the future. Much of the city's urban forest is comprised of residential trees. In fact, we anticipate approximately 135,000 new residential households in the next 20 years, and these new regulations will ensure that the city's forest is protected both today and into the future. The urban tree canopy is valued at $5 billion as a city asset, and the citizens of Portland get about $38 million of a benefit from trees every year. Those are wide-ranging. They include cleaner air, but they also include increased property values, increased profits for retail businesses, reduced stress and improved human health for those living near trees, and reduced stormwater management costs. With that, I'm going to pass it over to my colleague, Paul Scarlett.
Thank you, Mike. Good afternoon. Paul Scarlett, Bureau of Development Services Director. First, I'm pleased to be part of this process and to express my support for the report. I first want to thank a key staff person, Mika Keenan, who's been responsible for helping to develop and carry forward the code or the council note from last time forward today. She also works closely with Mike Hayakawa, and together, along with the land use staff and of course, working with staff from the Bureau of Parks and Recreation and Jen Kiner and others and BES, there's been great collaboration in working out some of the details that's part of this report. The report includes information that will be shared with you by Mika and Jen that speaks to some of the regulations provisions that will allow for development services to require more tree preservations for development projects. The amendments to TAL 33 will focus more on tree preservation and actually will allow for more robust planting of higher quality, larger trees, and as part of land divisions and also as part of land use reviews. In fact, it will be in lieu of land use reviews, you can improve and complement the urban forester with these type of trees through tree preservation in lieu of long, lengthy, and even costly, complex land use review cases. So it'll be a lot more straightforward. Like Commissioner Fritz, I was involved in a lot of the early conversations around streamlining the various tree regulations that exist in a variety of codes. Certainly pleased about the portion of the tree project that was adopted and went into effect. We're focused now on phase two in getting that adopted, hopefully in January of 2015. But the involvement of the Bureau of Development Services with BES and with Parks and Recreation, this is a very collaborative process, and we're more than happy to be part of it and looking forward to a successful outcome. Thank you. I'll turn it over to Dean.
Good afternoon, Mayor Hales, members of the Council, Dean Marriott, Environmental Services Director. Well, we have a lot riding on this because when Commissioner Saltzman helped make the decision for properly sizing the combined sewer overflow tunnels, we consciously counted on the use of green infrastructure so that we could properly size those tunnels and not overbuild them. So we saved ratepayers over $100 million in properly sizing those tunnels, and we rely on green infrastructure to manage stormwater. And trees, the urban tree canopy, is part of that green infrastructure. Just in the past 5 years, we've planted over 32,000 trees in Portland in order to help achieve that stormwater management goal and to help keep the Willamette and the Columbia Slough and the Columbia clean. I really want to recommend to you this report because I think it helps us make sure that we properly manage the existing tree canopy we have so that we're not spending money to plant new trees and yet ignoring the existing tree canopy. So I think it serves the community very well. My colleague Mike Abate mentioned the benefits to energy, air quality, and property values. We wholeheartedly endorse that, and I recommend this report to you. Thank you.
If I could just make one comment, Mayor. I started my history on this project began with Parks and now is extended to BES, and who knows, all someday we may be working together. But the what you just said, Dean, I hope is stated and restated every time we talk about the green infrastructure. Because one of the most important things I've learned in a very brief period of time that I've been at BES is that we assume the environmental benefits of the green infrastructure. We assume things like clean air, clean water, shade, temperature, livability, all the things. We often lead with those arguments, but what you just said was in the CSO program, we actually save money because of investing in nature. And I believe the most effective way going forward for us to talk about the investments in green infrastructure may not actually be leading with the environmental piece because everyone's going to put a different value on that in terms of short-term and long-term, but begin with the return on investment because that's actually our strongest case, that harnessing nature saves money over the traditional technology. Mm-hmm. And then everybody can value that environmental piece differently. And so I hope that becomes a recurring theme when we talk about the green infrastructure because I think it's the frankly, it's the part that sometimes our critics don't fully understand. And if I'm a ratepayer or a taxpayer and you said I can save money by using the green infrastructure and I didn't care about the environment, I'd still be a supporter. And we need to continually highlight the fact that in the long run it saves us money.
Good point. I'm glad you emphasized it because that's why I mentioned it. It was an important decision years ago when we properly sized the tunnels. And we're proving every day that the investment in green infrastructure saves ratepayers money.
$100 million in ratepayers' money, and to emphasize, not a penny of ratepayers' money is proposed to be spent in the implementation of this project. It's all general fund.
That's correct. Thank you.
So I'd like now to ask our Interbureau project team to come to the table. Jen Cairo, our city's urban forester, Roberta Jortner, the lead planner from the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, and leading off the presentation, Mika Keenan, the citywide tree project coordinator from the Bureau of Development Services.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. My name is Mika Keenan. I'm the program coordinator for tree code implementation. I work for both the Bureau of Development Services and Portland Parks and Recreations, helping the bureaus get ready for a successful tree code implementation. We are here today to present the Bureau's implementation, staffing, and budget plan as directed by City Council this past May. Since project adoption in 2011, the bureaus have been working diligently at setting up the necessary procedures to administer the new regulations, including but not limited to computer programming, new applications and new application requirements, and all of the various workflows and processes that need to be in place to make sure that we have a seamless and integrated implementation. The staffing proposal today is based on these code requirements as well as public expectations for customer service. This proposal meets the minimum staffing requirements for successful administration of the new codes. A lot of work has gone into creating the budget, both when the project was adopted and by the special projects manager who evaluated the tree code implementation requirements. As directed by council, the bureaus have evaluated the initial estimates and updated the budget projections based on current costs. And that's what we're presenting to you today and also what is included in the report. Both bureaus will continue to work with their budget advisors from their bureaus as well as the City Budget Office in refining their estimates, and will come back during the regular budget cycle for the final requirements. We are here today to ask that you accept our report. But before we get into more of the details, Roberta Jortner from the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability will give us a brief overview on the history, purpose, and highlights of the tree project. Roberta?
Thank you. Excuse me. Good afternoon. I am going to start with the impetus for the tree project, or some of the problems that we're trying to solve. As Commissioner Fritz described, community dissatisfaction with Portland's tree regulations is longstanding. Residents are concerned primarily about lack of protection for trees and loss of trees to new development, inconsistent regulations, confusion about tree permitting requirements, difficulty finding the right city staff to go to with questions and complaints, and lack of enforcement. Well, developers don't like the existing rules either. They characterize them as rigid, unpredictable, and ineffective in attaining the desired results. Staff are frustrated because the rules are spread between 8 different titles, and they're full of gaps and conflicts and ambiguities. And as was mentioned, another influence on the project was the growing awareness of the benefits of trees that Director Abate alluded to. And I think it's recognized that although the city, unlike many other cities in the country, is actually holding fairly steady on its overall tree canopy, some parts of the city canopy is going down, other parts is going up, and there are major disparities in tree canopy across Portland neighborhoods. And this came up during the hearings, that trees are an equity issue, and particularly in areas of infill development. And as we're expecting considerable growth, as Director Abate referred to, the new regulations provide a basic safeguard and also a mechanism for regenerating the urban forest over time as the city grows. In addition, the 2009 Climate Action Plan and the 2012 Portland Plan also call for enhancement of the urban forest and stronger tools. As Commissioner Fritz alluded to, the citywide tree project was initiated in response to community concerns. And in 2007, the City Council adopted the city's first urban forest action plan that also called for a comprehensive project to update the city's tree regulations. Concerned citizens approached council during that budget cycle, and council agreed to fund the project. Planning and Sustainability was tasked with leading the multi-bureau effort and worked closely with Development Services, Parks, and BES throughout, and brought in transportation and water along the way as needed to deal with infrastructure issues. Community participation was really at the heart of the project and began with the project scoping. It was a public process and continued with the convening of a diverse and very lively stakeholder group representing neighborhoods, home builders, industrial and institutional uses, watershed councils, arborists, Friends of Trees, Audubon, and others. And over 8 months, this group devoted collectively more than 1,000 hours to help shape the proposals. Staff attended dozens of meetings in the community as well during this period and to the end of the project. The initial proposals were vetted by staff and the stakeholders at the Planning and Urban Forestry Commissions. This was Pre-Planning and Sustainability Commission in early 2009, and the commissions provided feedback and support to move forward, and that's when we entered into code drafting in earnest and working with the bureaus to estimate costs, fiscal impacts, and staffing needs. The proposed draft was published, and the Planning Commission and Urban Forestry Commission held an unprecedented joint hearings, and I'm serious, we had 18 people that we were listening together in one room as more than 70 individuals, agencies, and organizations provided testimony. And over a five-month period, the two commissions worked hard with staff to address the concerns that were raised, directing changes to both strengthen and simplify the code and also to reduce costs. That was the primary goal of the commissions as they worked for to make it work. They also wanted to make sure that the code was compatible with the city's development goals. And Chris Smith from the Planning and Sustainability Commission will be addressing this a bit in his remarks. The City Council kicked off their public hearing to consider the Joint Planning and Urban Forestry Commission's recommendation in February 2011. Council heard at least 2 hours of testimony, largely in support of the proposal, but also heard some concerns and outstanding issues, and met twice more on the project, directed additional revisions, and adopted the package unanimously on April 13, 2011, with broad-based support from home builders, Columbia Corridor Association, neighborhoods, Audubon, and many others. And you're familiar with the phased implement.
I want to interject there. To me, it was very similar to what we did on the earned sick leave, that we had a preliminary hearing. We then took a lot more input and made a number of revisions between the council hearings. So it's kind of analogous to that process, where a lot of vetting of what the policy should be.
Right. There was a check sheet that the council went through, and we went one by one through about 20 different decisions that the council had to make. And that was enlivening. And you're familiar with the phased implementation proposal and the current effective date. So finally, what was adopted? What are the highlights of this package? First, a suite of customer service improvements, including improved online permit tracking, a new tree website, and this will allow the public to access tree permit information and other program information more readily, and a new single point of contact will provide a one-stop shop to respond to public inquiries and complaints. The tree project package also features a new consolidated tree code, Title 11, trees, and Title 11 establishes this integrated regulatory framework for trees on public and private property and in development and non-development situations. New tree preservation and planting standards will apply on development sites and to infrastructure projects. They will apply through existing building permit processes and will not trigger additional reviews. They provide flexibility, allowing developers to pay a fee in lieu of preservation or planting, and the city can use the revenue from these fees to plant trees within the same watershed and can focus on tree-deficient areas to help with redistributing the canopy and addressing the equity issues that currently exist. New flexible criteria, as was mentioned, will improve the quality of tree preservation and land divisions, and the code provides more options for root protection on development sites, which will give developers more choices while hopefully encouraging more trees to be preserved. When a property owner wants to remove a tree and there's no development on their property, or they can, a standardized tree permit system will replace the current piecemeal approach. Tree removal permits will be required based on the size, health, and number of trees to be removed rather than the type of the property the tree is on. Confusing single-family lot exemptions will be replaced by a simpler system that applies uniformly citywide. And the system will allow removal of most trees with a simple, basic tree-for-tree replacement, with additional mitigation required for removal of very large healthy trees or multiple trees. And the new code updates and standardizes enforcement procedures. So in summary, the adopted package addresses most of the key concerns that were raised during the process, both in terms of things that Portlanders wanted the city to address and issues and concerns that came up along the way. However, we know the system will need to be tested and will likely need to be tweaked in the future as we learn more and we monitor. And now I'll hand it over to Jen.
Thank you. Councilors, I'm Jen Cairo, the city forester and a city nature zone manager for Community Gardens, Horticultural Services, and Urban Forestry for the Parks Bureau. And what I'm going to present today is some of the steps we've taken to date to advance the new code goals in spite of delayed implementation, and also some information on the staff positions needed to implement the new code. So here on this slide, you'll see some of the key accomplishments towards new code implementation to date. I'm going to highlight just a couple of these, those being housekeeping amendments have been completed. These made clarifications to the adopted code. Also, the online tree pruning permits have been up and running for several months now and are performing well. Through this system, property owners are able to instantly self-issue tree pruning permits for simpler pruning needs at their convenience, rather than going through an application and issuance process with city offices. And the last one I'd highlight was that among the processes already developed to support new code implementation is a monitoring or program evaluation plan, which will help us evaluate how well we are meeting the new code goals in order to make adjustments as needed and appropriate. Lastly, I would say that in this interim period, development services and park staff have been working hard and collaborating closely for about 2 years now to achieve these and other implementation steps. This type of collaboration also advances the new code intention of creating a consistent tree regulation program that fits together seamlessly, regardless of regulating bureau. On to staffing needs. One of our objectives in understanding the staffing needs for the new code included meeting the basic project goals that you've been hearing about from Roberta and others. Those include improved customer service, such as faster permit and information turnaround times, clearer public information and simpler processes, more protection of existing trees and the public benefits that they provide to us all, especially from larger trees, and also consistent, predictable requirements that are better enforced. So the staff recommendations being presented are derived from those initial projections included when the tree project at the time of code adoption in 2011. When the code was adopted, the bureaus were directed to review the budget assumptions and needs as they got closer to implementation based on their then deeper understanding of the new requirements. The project presented in 2011 or project needs presented in 2011 were based on analysis of permit volumes over 3 years and the time and staffing needs to accomplish specific permitting processes. For example, the time needs for staff to travel to an inspection location, how much time that staff would need on site to perform the tree inspection duties, how much time would be needed to perform plan reviews for development plans, and similar. And this resulted in the amount of staff needed for a permit process that was then extrapolated across permit volumes for a year. We use the same method again, the same one that was used to create the 2011 numbers, applied to last year 2012's permit volumes to ground truth basically what the staffing needs would be. Planning and sustainability has assisted with this, as have the finance managers from the bureaus involved, and the city budget office has been comfortable with the methods used. Our goal throughout has been to determine the minimum staffing needs to effectively apply the new code and meet the tree protection, smoother regulation, and customer service goal demands. The result is minimum staffing needs that are largely consistent with those initially projected. In addition, what we'll present to you today are the estimated costs, which now include direct and indirect costs, and the changing costs between the 2011 recommendations and now, while the initial cost estimate included salaries and benefits only. Mika will speak more to this shortly. Lastly, please note that we are reporting today only estimates that will be further refined during the regular budget cycle, and the bureaus and implementation team will continue to work closely with the city budget office and finance managers to complete the budget work. Sorry, hang on 1 second. Here we go. Okay. I will present the specific staffing needs for the new code now. Please note that none of the positions requested are management positions. Supervision and program management needs will be absorbed by existing staff. The first position to discuss is the single point of contact, as we call it, and this classification is a development services technician 2. These folks will be supervised by Urban Forestry, but located at the development services center in order to have these staff available where customers come for most of their other city permit needs. These staff are basically the one-stop shop for all things tree. They are the frontline staff for all tree-related questions. They'll be the first person in most cases that the public interfaces with regarding any tree-related questions, including permit processes, regulations, and costs. They will bridge the gap between development services and urban forestry in terms of tree requirements for development permits so that residents and property owners will not have to ferret out such information on their own. They will issue some types of simple tree permits directly and be responsible for doing the initial review of reported violations, such as checking existing permits and permit history to see if an activity that's being reported is indeed permitted or not. The original staffing proposal assumed that other unspecified staff who work on other tasks would assist with these duties. To provide effective and quicker customer service, however, means that these need to be dedicated staff who know both zoning code and tree code requirements, how to issue permits, understand something about tree management, and have some basic tree knowledge. Workload also significantly exceeds the capacity of one full-time employee. For example, their daily tasks will include calls and email volumes that we estimate will be around 70 per day, and that's something they have to receive and then respond to. This is approximately what the Urban Forestry Office alone currently handles on a daily basis. And that often requires more than one position, one person to receive and respond to those inquiries. Added to this function are other necessary and distinctive tasks, such as the basic permit issuance, website maintenance, and serving as a resource and coordination point for Bureau staff on each Bureau's tree requirements. Given these needs, two of these positions are needed. This is one more than was initially proposed in 2011.
Just to clarify, Jen, you currently get 70 calls per day to urban forestry?
We on an average, we get around 70 calls and emails per day. And if there's a storm, we get more.
And if we're protecting more trees or doing more with trees, we'll need that volume would likely increase.
Would go up. And another distinction to be made is that's just what we track at the forestry office. So if these folks are going to cover those sorts of inquiries as well as those received by development services for development type situations, that volume will be significantly more. Tree inspectors are supervised by urban forestry. However, those responsible for trees in development situations will be located at the development services center. These staff will inspect development projects when tree preservation is required, and this includes things like root protection fencing, investigating tree health, and seeing if there is consistency with approved site plans. Tree planting for on-site trees and street trees when five or more trees are required to be planted will also be checked, and they will be looking for things like tree species, tree location, and again, consistency with site plans. These staff will also respond to reported violations for development projects, such as trees removed or damaged that were to be retained, or if root protection zones have been removed or relocated. We are requesting one additional inspector based on our 2012 permit levels and the tasks required to complete each permit process. Our assumptions are the same as those made in 2011, and those are that each permit will receive one inspection, although some will receive zero inspections, in fact, and others will have up to four inspections, especially if there is a reported violation or concern. So our estimates indicate that we actually need 2.4 tree inspectors to fulfill these tasks. But we'll be evaluating that after implementation and are only requesting two. Title 11 regulation expands the situations where a tree permit is required. Currently, a tree removal permit is needed under a limited number of situations depending on the zoning and lot size. The new code will increase the number of regulated properties by about 35%. That indicates new additional work for some staff. More permits, potentially, but hopefully not many, more violations and more enforcement actions. This means additional time for tree inspectors to review capital projects. This also includes, additional time for tree inspectors to review capital projects under the new regulations, and there are some additional processes in that as well. So this request has remained the same from the initial estimate in 2011 of 1.5 positions. And last, we have two more positions. The city planner, too, is responsible for tree preservation and planting requirements for more types of development projects. Currently, most tree planting requirements are associated with new single-family construction. The new regulations require tree preservation and planting for more types of development projects. And land use reviews require planners, such as the city planner, too, to review tree requirements during their review. This is a new requirement. There are new tasks that will add time to each review, and the additional planner will absorb the added time for permit reviews, keeping review times efficient for people who are applying for permits. 1.5 city planner, 2 positions are required to review the additional regulation in the tree code and zoning amendments. So that remains the same as was projected in 2011. And last but not least, there's also a temporary position that will exist only for a fiscal year, and that is the program coordinator. This would disappear after August 2015. And the program coordinator is the person who really oversees implementation of the new code, and that is Mika's position currently. And they will be assisting with hiring and training staff, developing the remaining bits of our outreach plan, and then implementing that so people are aware of the code and how it affects their business and their properties. And will help the Bureau's transition to new regulation during the first 6 months of implementation. Again, the staffing levels recommended here are the minimum needed to apply the code, and it's important to understand that the new tree code creates new work to be done, which requires some new people to do it.
Thank you, Jen. I'm going to go through an overview of the budget summary.
Maybe just a quick question there,
yep.
If I could jump in, and that is maybe it's more of a question for Paul after your presentation, but so we've gone to a great deal of trouble to have our inspectors be cross-trained and do multiple things. Some of us remember when there were plumbing inspectors and mechanical inspectors and structural inspectors and electrical inspectors, and now we have one person doing all that for residential construction. Why are we abandoning that principle here and having dedicated inspectors when we've proven the ability to cross-train people to do multiple things? You save that question for later if you want, Paul, but I'd be interested in hearing that. I wasn't here for the original discussion about this ordinance, but just as a matter of principle, we have tried to combine disciplines rather than separate them. So
absolutely. I think that's a good question, Mayor. What, in deference to the fact that we started an hour late, what I'd like to do is
follow up
certainly
on that
air the questions but not get the answers, and then get to citizen testimony, and then our staff will come back.
Good suggestion. I'll abide by it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So I am going to review the budget summary for the first year of implementation as well as the second year of implementation and ongoing, and I'm just going to explain this chart a bit. So in the left-hand column, you'll see all of the positions that Jen just explained. Then you'll the column next to that, FTE, is the full-time equivalent position, and that's how many staff we're proposing to fill each of those positions. You'll see the general fund request for year one, then you're going to see the general fund request for year two, and the fees that will cover part of the project costs that will start in year two. You should note that the first year of implementation is prorated because the project is going to be in effect for 6 months, January through June, consistent with what was adopted in 2011, or proposed in 2011, I should say. We're asking that the general fund support 100% of implementation for those first 6 months. In year two and thereafter, fees will pick up approximately 50% of those costs. So you'll see in year one, we're asking for 8.5 full-time equivalents. Two of those positions are temporary. As Jen had mentioned, the program coordinator position is a temporary position and will go away in year two. Also for public outreach, we're requesting 0.5 of an FTE to make sure that we can do a broad and robust outreach plan. That will also go away in year two. You'll notice that the costs are higher than what were initially estimated in at the time of project adoption. That's for a few reasons. First and foremost, it's because we're asking for two additional staff, as Jen explained, one for a tree inspector and one for a DSC Tech 2. Employee costs are much higher today than they were in 2011, and we've included the growth rates in those projections. So the numbers that you see are what we're anticipating employees will cost in 2014 and ongoing. We've also been asked by our budget advisors to include indirect costs. as well as the direct costs above and beyond just salary and benefits. So this includes rent, insurance for employees, as well as Comcast and BTS expenses. And that rate, which is different than the cost of living increased rate, has also been included here. We're also asking for two additional cars for the inspectors. And the two additional employees above what was asked for in 2011. So the next steps for implementation, we're requesting funding be available for July 1st, 2014. The reason we're asking for it for July 1st, 2014 is that so staff has the money in the bank, so to speak, so we can start recruiting the necessary staff and get the staff trained for a January 1st, 2015 implementation. We'll be hiring staff in the fall and in the winter, especially for the development services Tech 2. That position is going to take some time to get hired and trained up. They're going to need to learn both the zoning code as well as the Title 11 code requirements. So we recommend that $350,000 in general fund one-time ask for fiscal year 2014 and 15 be provided, and approximately $430,000 ongoing for 2014 and 2015 as well. Again, these are estimates, and the bureaus will continue to work with their budget directors as well as the City Budget Office to refine these estimates during the regular city budget process. This concludes our presentation if you guys have any questions.
Mayor, before we lose this panel, can I ask you and Commissioner Fritz just a procedural question? I'm beginning to feel like a trailblazer in the second of a back-to-back road game, because after the 2 days of hearings we've had, my mind is getting mushy, but I just want to understand. We're being asked today to accept this report, which is to receive it.
That's right.
The report has recommendations as to staffing and funding, and we've already received some communication from the public saying it's either not enough or it's too lavish. Technically, what we're doing is hearing testimony today on the report, but my understanding is the decision-making doesn't occur until we go into our next budget cycle, and then we'll do the hard work of drilling down, looking at what the available resources are, the color of money, and how much we want to invest. So there's really, in a sense, two bites at the apple: accepting the report today, which has a recommendation, but then the deliberative part of our budget process of looking at trade-offs and sources of money. Am I correct?
That's correct. Neither these bureaus nor any other can prescript the budget process, but they can make recommendations, and they're doing so.
Yeah.
And we accept the report, which contains their recommendations, but that doesn't automatically budget anything.
Exactly, and the report is responsive to your budget note, and Commissioner Saltzman is saying bring it by December of 13. That's what we're doing. What I would like is for you to air your questions without getting answers for them right now. We can certainly, if the council is not comatose on the floor by the end of the hearing, get staff back to answer the questions, or we can bring that back in another setting. As I said, I want to get to the citizen testimony.
Yeah, and
I want to hear your questions, though.
I think the questions we'll put on the record, but we're not here to debate people's individual preferences of more money or less.
Correct.
We're here to make sure we understand the rationale for that, and then that will inform our budget discussions.
Right. Thank you for
and
framing
that. I think in terms of being humane, I'd rather pose questions and get them answered later, including my own.
So thank you.
So does anybody have questions that they want to put down right now?
No, I guess that mine stood earlier, but would also apply to the other costs like vehicles and all the rest, that, you know, duplication of administrative infrastructure versus combination. So we can talk more about that.
Right.
Well, Jen, my question is, you have four current and former Parks Commissioners here. In the privacy of this room, would you rank them in terms of effectiveness?
I plead the fifth, Commissioner.
Yeah.
It's a good point, Commissioner Fish, because I think we do need to stop here and thank Hannah Kuhn, who's now your chief of staff, who was the architect of bringing this, the first set of recommendations. I'm particularly pleased that this set mirrors what Hannah's group had put forward, but then updates them in light of the current budget.
Thank you for saying that, and I'm especially appreciative that Hannah has served under three or four different mayors, and she is almost becoming the institutional memory in this building, and I'm honored to have her on my team, so thank you. For
got quite a bit of institutional memory here, too, so thank you very much for your presentation. It's now my pleasure to introduce our two panels, and the first, our commissioners, Chris Smith of the Planning and Sustainability Commission, Mike Houck of the Planning and Sustainability Commission, and Merrill Reddish, the chair of the Urban Forestry Commission. Thank you all for being here and for your patience.
Well, thank you. I'm Chris Smith. I'm a member of the Planning and Sustainability Commission. But when we started this project, I was on the Planning Commission, not the Planning and Sustainability Commission. We did this project before we combined the two commissions, and Commissioner Houck joined us at that time. As Roberta Joyner pointed out, this was a unique process. We had several joint meetings between the Planning Commission and the Urban Forestry Commission as we worked through this. This is an incredibly complex set of issues because of all the organizations that have a hand in this, and because until we did this project, it was sprinkled all over the city's code. So this project was very important in unifying that. We heard from a large number of individuals and institutions at the time that we did the project. There was a clear, consistent message from neighborhoods that they were concerned about loss of trees due both to unregulated cutting and to cutting occurring in situations where enforcement resources might be difficult to rally to prevent it. We heard from the development community that they wanted more clarity and certainty in the code than they enjoyed under the old code. So we were very pleased to put this to council 3 years ago and have it adopted. I play a liaison role between the Planning and Sustainability Commission and the budget advisors, so I was then also on the other side of the difficult choices about what could be funded and not, and certainly understand the choices to delay implementation due to fiscal constraints. But I think we're now in a slightly better season fiscally, and I think it's very important that we take the time to look at this. This is it's an infrastructure system. I mean, we sometimes tend to think of trees as an amenity, but they are part of the infrastructure of the city. And this plan, which very consciously sets out to increase the tree canopy in the city, is really about building infrastructure in many ways, and it is foundational to a lot of our other plans. And I will pass the baton to my fellow commissioner, who will tell you about that.
Chris, can I just ask you one question? One criticism raised this week was we're regulating with too heavy a hand. There are other priorities for our general fund, and we should scrap this program altogether. Do you have a comment?
I guess my first reaction is I would not care to go redo the 18 months of work that we did to develop this plan. I think, like any other piece of infrastructure, it requires investment. And, with trees, that investment generally occurs with individual property owners. I think we owe those property owners clarity and certainty about how that will work, but I don't think we can relieve them of that burden any more than we can relieve them of the burden to maintain their sidewalks.
If I may, since I wasn't here for the 18 months, Chris, can you elaborate on that and respond to what I think was the Oregonian editorial board's argument that's basically, if somebody wants to cut down a tree on their property and replace it with a flower garden, why shouldn't they be allowed to do that?
Because I think that is the core of the argument. For the first time, we're regulating trees in people's backyards other than in sensitive places like environmental zones. So it is a change in philosophy. But I think it comes from the recognition that that tree provides a service not just to that property owner but to the whole neighborhood and, indeed, in some ways, to the whole city in terms of what it does for air quality, capturing stormwater, a whole host of benefits other people have talked about. Cutting down your tree doesn't just impact you.
I was actually around, I think it was 20 years ago when we got together. I was on the advisory committee that advised the city regarding the CSO program. And it's interesting, this morning I was on a conference call with folks. I'm on a panel back east specifically to talk about Portland's Green Infrastructure Program, and there was an EPA rep. And she went on and on about how Portland is a model for the nation with regard to green infrastructure. 20 years ago, we couldn't get EPA to really allow the city to implement a lot of green infrastructure. I reminded her of that. And we'll have an interesting conversation back east in a few weeks. Commissioner Fish stole my testimony. I have three words for the editorial board at the Oregonian and anyone else who would criticize this program.
There are family and children watching this program. So.
Well, return on investment, and I think that is what we need to lead with. The city's urban forest, a $5 billion capital asset and one of the most important components of the city's green infrastructure, provides multiple functions. I won't enumerate them. You've heard about them earlier, including what we now refer to as ecosystem services, which really means, bottom line, where the city is more economically healthy than it would be without the green infrastructure. In addition, the Portland plan specifically calls for funding the tree program and establish the urban forest canopy as one measure of success. The draft comprehensive plan also calls for protecting, managing, and maintaining a healthy urban forest canopy as one element of the city's healthy connected neighborhoods and design with nature. The city and county climate action plan and draft climate preparation strategy both recognize an expanded healthy urban forest canopy as a critical tool to address climate change, both from a mitigation and an adaptation or preparation perspective. But absent all the myriad reasons that you've been given, I'll go back to ROI. This is one of the best triple bottom line decisions you could possibly make. A healthy, thriving urban forest improves ecological and human health, importantly, and is an investment that will literally grow over time. Thank you.
Good afternoon, and thank you for giving me the opportunity. As chair of the Urban Forestry Commission, I want to express the views of the commission, and that is that we unanimously support the implementation of the plan. And here is why. You heard, of course, a lot of the reasons, and I was part of the work session and part of the engagement process. And from my view, there was unprecedented support from the spectrum of community activists to developers, homeowners, arbor care professionals. And I think it would send a terrible message to people who put in thousands of hours to either testify or give input and help craft a document that protects a $5 billion asset. Commissioner Novick, you asked about the private property piece. And one of the things that I haven't heard yet is the following case to be made for why a regulatory approach and permits are necessary. And permits help track the trends of what is happening. So it's a tool to use from the agency standpoint as well as from professionals and people who care about expanding and increasing our canopy about what is happening to large, healthy trees on both public and private lands and the unintended consequences that happen when we lose big trees, shade, wildlife habitat, stormwater management, carbon sequestration. So I look at it also as a tool to help us track what is happening in our on our landscape.
But just to play devil's advocate for a minute.
Okay.
I mean, it's not just a matter of tracking, right? You also, if you cut down a tree, you're supposed to plant a new one, right?
That's correct.
So you're not allowed to say, this used to be a place where a tree is, and now it's going to be a flower garden for the rest of my life.
I'm not quite sure I understand where you're...
So it's not just about tracking. It also has substantive implications.
Sure. And the other point I want to make is that it does not preclude homeowners from cutting down trees. It doesn't necessarily mean that people will not be able to cut down the trees. It provides a review and a way for, once again, the city to look at what is happening on the landscape.
But if it's a large enough tree, aren't they required to replace it by planting another tree?
That is correct.
Or to pay a fee in lieu.
Oh,
so
yes,
if you do want a flower garden, you can go there, but you're going
to have to replace
the values to the community of the tree that you cut.
Yeah.
Again, just to play devil's advocate, there's a lot of things people can do with their own property and their own families that have an impact on society at large. For example, if you feed your kids a lot of junk food, they're likely to wind up unhealthy and to drive up everybody's health insurance premiums. But we haven't yet started prohibiting people from feeding their kids junk food. So how would you draw that distinction?
Maybe we should invite former Mayor Bloomberg to Portland. And
no, but I think Steve raises an interesting point. But we don't, for example, allow people to do bonfires in their backyard.
Mm-hmm.
We don't allow people to store hazardous materials in their garages. We don't allow people to take fats, oil, and greases and dump them into the stream. And so it's, I suppose, from one view of freedom, and particularly from a libertarian point of view that says property rights trump community rights, there is a principled argument to be made that hands off my tree. But if we view the tree as having a larger community benefit, like clean air, clean water, stormwater management, and other things, here we're treating it sort of like our health and safety codes that we do with built structures we're treating a live structure similar to an inanimate structure in terms of the regulatory scheme. I think your point has more, as a devil advocate, has more currency around the question of, is the regulatory footprint reasonable, which I think we have to monitor. We're not trying to create an onerous set of burdens.
I think it's worth pointing out that it's a fairly large tree before we exert our regulatory footprint, and there was a vigorous debate about how big a tree that would trigger it during the original adoption, and we settled on a larger radius than what we started with the initial proposal. So it's not like we haven't looked at where that threshold should be.
Yeah, we compromised quite a bit on this. And just as...
Meryl, would you put your name in the record?
Sure, I'm sorry. My name's Meryl Reddish.
You know who she is. We know who you are.
And where I live, probably. And just to follow up, I wanted to just underscore that the implementation of a new code will require clear and compelling communications plan that focuses on the positive attributes of how this works, why it was done, and how it will benefit the community. And the Urban Forestry Commission welcomes the opportunity to help deliver that message. We greatly appreciate staff at Parks, Development Services, and the Planning and Sustainability Bureaus for all of their good work, and we thank you for your expression of sincere support last year, and we look forward to that support again.
Thank you very much. Cool. Appreciate this panel.
Thanks for your many hours of volunteer
Indeed,
service.
And thank you.
Meryl, do we get to fuss over you later? Is there something later in the calendar year we get to fuss over you?
If you like. Our second panel, is Bob Salinger here?
Yes.
Great. He's on the Tree Project Stakeholder Discussion Group. Scott Fogarty was not able to stay, but Susie Peterson is representing the Friends of Trees, and Greg Shifsky, one of the first stalwarts who started this project from Southwest Portland, is also joining us.
Good afternoon, Mayor Hills and members of the City Council. My name is Bob Salinger. I'm the Conservation Director for Portland Audubon Society. I'm also on the Parks Board and the Parks Budget Committee as well. I'm here today representing Audubon, though. Both Jim Labby and I served on the Tree Advisory Committee on behalf of Audubon. We were actually one of the groups that advocated for that committee starting back in 2005. So we've been talking about this for a long time, and it was a long, inclusive, good process, representative with a lot of stakeholders at the table, and folks supported moving forward on this. And so it was exciting when it was eventually ratified by council. We're here to strongly urge you to accept the report today and to implement this plan. We consider this package a critical part of our green infrastructure. Every bit as important as planting trees, putting in eco-roofs, building green streets. This is a $5 billion asset, as you've already heard, and we need to take care of it. We would not put in a sewer and then ignore it. This infrastructure needs to be treated just like any other infrastructure, and we need the mechanisms to educate people about how to take care of it, how to protect it, and we need regulations to ensure that we continue to increase our canopy, not decrease it. As I said, I think taking care of our trees is every bit as important as planting them, and it's all the more so because, as you've already heard today, this is an asset that increases in value over time. Unlike a lot of assets that deteriorate, a tree provides more and more ecosystem services the longer it's in the ground. So that investment pays back more and more the longer that tree is there. We need to not just plant them, but make sure they survive and provide those community benefits. That's where we get the return on investment over time. It's long been recognized that our code is insufficient, confusing, contradictory, and inadequate. And you'll see some rhetoric out there I have about what's the concern? Our tree canopy has increased over time. Everything's fine. Don't worry about it. In fact, that's not the case. I mean, it has increased. But if we want to get to our target of 33% canopy, at the rate we're currently going, it'll take about 160 years. So we're increasing, but we're on a very slow trajectory. We also know that our trees are getting narrower, more columnar. We're losing our big trees. So the trees that really provide the greatest ecosystem values, the best return on investment, are slowly being replaced by much smaller trees because we don't have an adequate system in place to really teach people how to take care of them and what to plant. As Chris Smith has already noted, we do need to treat it like any other infrastructure. So I would just end by noting that this plan was supported by a broad array of stakeholders, not just the environmental community, not just the neighborhoods, but also the development community. They wanted a plan that was clearer, less confusing. So with that, I really do hope we move forward and implement this. The last thing I would just say is addressing Commissioner Novick's comments and question. If we are going to get to that target of 33%, it's going to happen across the entire landscape. It can't just be in the public right of ways. It's got to involve people's backyards. We're all stakeholders in this process. We all have a vested interest in making sure that our green infrastructure is adequate. That's what protects our gray infrastructure and keeps that value in place as well. So I think we all have a role to play. One other point that I think is important to take into account is a lot of times these trees were put in as a condition of development. But when that development turns over and becomes just a basic private lot, then somebody can turn around and cut those trees down. So we don't have a system in place that protects that investment that's sometimes initially required over the life of that investment. So there are a lot of reasons, I think very legitimate reasons, to say that private property owners really do have a responsibility to protect, maintain those investments, contribute to the overall health of our landscape. And I would emphasize the fact that they do not have to plant another tree in that exact same spot. They can put it into a fund to plant elsewhere. So they can put in their garden, but they have to do some mitigation. We felt that mitigation was too low, frankly. That was probably one of the most contentious issues, and it was substantially weakened to make sure that it wouldn't be onerous on people beyond an unreasonable level. So thank you.
Thanks for being here, Bob.
Susie? Hi, my name is Susie Peterson. I'm with Friends of Trees, and Scott Fogarty was hoping to speak tonight. And so what I'm reading is what he has written. So pretend like I have shorter hair, a deeper voice, and some of these points I know have already been touched on tonight, but I don't want to cut corners on what I promised him I would read, so I'm just going to go for it. Good afternoon, Mayor Hales and Commission members. My name is Scott Fogarty, and I am Executive Director of Friends of Trees. Thank you for the opportunity to share some thoughts on the Consolidated Tree Code and for taking time to recognize the social and economic values of trees and the very important role they play in our community. I participated on the stakeholder committee that reviewed this issue over the last 3.5 years. Overall, I do believe that a uniform application of regulations is needed to address multiple issues with regard to trees and overall support the citywide tree project. I'm speaking on behalf of our organization and for the trees that have no voice. Friends of Trees serves a variety of roles in planting and protecting trees, including taking a lead on watershed health improvements, recruiting volunteers and sponsors, educating the public about the values of trees, and helping to influence tree policy at the local, state, and federal levels. Trees are a $5 billion asset of the city and provide watershed health ecosystem services that complement traditional infrastructure services and provide collateral benefits. Among an array of benefits, trees clean our air and water, absorb toxic particulate matter from roadways, increase our property values, sequester carbon dioxide, mitigate urban stormwater, reduce urban heat island effects, increase the energy efficiency in our buildings, reduce neighborhood crime, provide wildlife habitat, and improve our quality of life and the livability of our city. Trees are recognized for their value and play a role in the success of many city plans and programs, including the Portland Watershed Management Plan, the Urban Forestry Plan, the Comprehensive Plan, and the Climate Change Action Plan. Yet today, protection for our urban trees is inconsistent at best. Dramatic increases in tree planting efforts over the past decade are undermined by lack of protection and mitigation requirements for trees, on much of our landscape, confusing and sometimes contradictory regulations, lack of educational outreach resources, and insufficient enforcement capabilities. As older and larger trees are being lost, we are increasingly replacing them with smaller and more columnar trees, which provide far fewer ecosystem services. As the old proverb states, the best time to plant a tree is today. The second best time was 30 years ago. The proposal that is being brought forward today will create clear, simple, consistent, and comprehensive protections for our urban trees. In order to achieve environmental and livability goals of the city, we cannot just plant thousands of trees. We must also have stronger regulations in place for the preservation of trees. Friends of Trees believes that if we are going to shoot for a 33%